this recording first came out, many listeners reached the same conclusion that pianist Hank Jones did when he heard it.
I thought it was a trick recording where perhaps they were using two or three piano players playing at the same time, and they were trying to get people to believe that this was one person playing. Well, as it turned out, there was only one person, and that one person was Art Tatum.
Having been a violinist, you know, and classically trained, he knew all about harmonics, you know, and all that stuff. And when he played he sounded like a dog. This cat was amazing.
His chord progressions from the 30s would be as modern as today.
Art had an incomparable depth of harmonic understanding, which he used to set his lines on, and this is what I think made him almost untouchable.
Basie called him the eighth wonder of the world. Art Tatum's technique was awe-inspiring, but perhaps even more so was the stream of ideas it allowed him to express. Writer Stanley Crouch once said, "Tatum modulated more in 8 bars than most musicians do in a lifetime." And for many listeners, this is too much. Yet the consensus among musicians is that Art Tatum was the most accomplished jazz pianist who ever lived. I'm Nancy Wilson. On this edition of Jazz Profiles, it's a look into the illustrious Art Tatum. Art Tatum has always been a controversial figure in jazz. Many people used to question whether he was a jazz pianist at all. Tatum biographer James Lester.
One of the best statements about how hard it was to place Tatum came from Whitney Balliot, who was the jazz writer for The New Yorker. He said no one ever knew exactly what he was or what to do with him. He was said to be the greatest jazz pianist who ever lived, and he was said to be not a jazz pianist at all. He was admired by classical pianists, by jazz musicians, and by dazzled, tin-eared laymen. People poked fun at his ornate style and then wept at his next brilliance. Nobody has decided yet what kind of a pianist he was. And I think that's still true.
Tatum was full of contradictions, not the least of which was a startling contrast of what you heard versus what you saw. What you heard was an incredible sense of movement. But what did you see?
The Sphinx.
Pianist Oscar Peterson.
Very little movement, body-wise. The only movement was from the elbow down.
He didn't go through all the calisthenics that some pianists go through.
Pianist Hank Jones.
As if to say that this is what you need to do in order to play the piano well. He didn't do that. The only thing that moved were his hands and his arms and his fingers.
Yeah, exactly.
Singer John Hendricks.
Like an accountant. You know, he just did his work.
Tiger Rag showcases Tatum's remarkable technical facility at the piano. He plays with unparalleled clarity and, in case you hadn't noticed, speed. Again, James Lester.
Steve Allen said something about listening to him is like riding past a Da Vinci on a bicycle. you really ought to stop and stand in front of a Da Vinci and look at the details and so forth, but everything goes past you so fast in Tatum that you can't do that.
Tatum himself was never fully satisfied with his technique, as he told radio host Willis Conover of the Voice of America Network in a 1956 interview.
Have you ever satisfactorily explained how you arrived at your technique, which is, of course, the joy and the despair of every other pianist?
Well, satisfactorily, I don't know. I couldn't say that because I don't feel that I have all of the technical facilities that I would like to have. I mean, I'm not... That's one of the things I think that that in years to come, I think a guy's technique gets better and better. He should. If he doesn't get better, then he should quit.
And maybe this was one of the secrets to Tatum's success, always striving to achieve. It seems he adopted this approach early in life.
He apparently was picking out hymns on the piano by the time he was three. I talked to somebody who had heard him give a small concert at the church when he was seven. And by the time he was 12, he was already playing for functions. So you could say he was launched.
Arthur Tatum Jr. was born October 13, 1909, in Toledo, Ohio. His mother, Mildred, and father, Art Sr., had a challenging time with parenthood. Their first child died in infancy. Art, who was their second child, had lost most of his sight by age four.
Whether he had childhood illnesses or whether he had congenital cataracts, we just don't know. His mother felt guilty, as if she might have done it, because she used to put him out on the front porch in Toledo in his crib soon after the sun came up and not think about him much anymore. And she worried that he'd gotten overexposed to sunlight lying there in his crib.
Though he underwent more than a dozen operations on his eyes, Art never permanently regained his sight. He was totally blind in one eye and had very limited vision in the other. But that didn't stop his thirst to pursue music. In his early teens, he began to study classical violin, which he played for 2 years. But as he liked to say, after 4 days of studying piano, he could already do more than he ever could on violin. With his growing arsenal of technique and his uncanny ability to improvise, Art landed a job as house pianist at Toledo's Waiters and Bellman's Club when he was 19. John Hendricks was hired to sing with him.
I was Little Johnny Hendricks, the Sepia of Bobby Green. That was my billing. And everybody asked me how I learned to scat, you know. I learned it from him, because he would say, sing this, you know. And I'd go, and he said, no, bing, 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 bing. I had to come by his house every day after school. I'm 14 years old. 14-year-old boys, you know, they want to do everything but go by some piano player's house.
Hendricks recalls the flocks of great jazz musicians who came to the club to hear Art. Louis Armstrong, Duke Ellington, Count Basie, Andy Kirk, Benny Goodman. Though Tatum hadn't ventured from the Midwest, the word was out that this young blind kid from Toledo could play more on the piano than anyone had heard before.
He was amazing. When I sang, I had the entire NBC Symphony Orchestra behind me, strings, woodwinds, and everything. Just that guy with his two hands. He was amazing.
Yesterday's. You're listening to NPR's Jazz Profiles, a tribute to Art Tatum. I'm Nancy Wilson. In 1932, a job accompanying singer Adelaide Hall finally introduced Art to New York City, the Mecca for jazz pianists, and the musicians there had long awaited his arrival. James Lester.
Fats Waller, James P. Johnson, had heard about him from traveling musicians who'd go out and come back. So they were waiting, eager to hear, but not really prepared for what they heard. Everybody says about the good musician they'd heard in some city when they're traveling, but you don't expect them to come out like Art Tatum when you actually hear them. So within weeks, he was the talk of the town among the musicians, and within a year was making solo recordings.
On March 21st, 1933, Tatum cut four sides for the Brunswick label in his first solo recording session. The first tune, T for Two, became his signature piece. Tatum's first solo recording, T for Two, from 1933. By now, Tatum was developing a highly sophisticated style, drawing from the full spectrum of musical sources. Pianist Dick Hyman is a champion of Tatum and has written numerous articles analyzing his style.
Tatum was really what you call a stride pianist. Stride piano had been around for at least 20 years before Tatum burst onto the scene, and he was well aware of people like James P. Johnson and Fats Waller. Stride piano sounded something like this. The thing that Tatum added to this was technically an arsenal of devices, some of which came straight out of the book of Liszt and Chopin. For example, simple scales, we'll say the minor scale, so that he would possibly throw that in at the end of a phrase like here. A run like that thrown in when the melody has a gap in it was characteristic of it. And he did it sometimes in both hands. He'd do this sort of thing. Some of his devices were not based on scales, they were based on arpeggios. So a thing like this, he might make more complicated by doing this. And those would be worked into songs perhaps like this.
Exceptionally sophisticated in his use of harmony. Pianist Billy Taylor.
he would take a tune like and reharmonize it. The whole idea of improvisation for most people is to take that melody and play around the melody. So you're playing around the melody. What he did was to take the melody and play it over and over and do something like this. Then he might do something like. So he was one of the most sophisticated users of contemporary harmony that I've ever met.
Body and Soul, recorded live July 26, 1941, at the G-Haw Stables in New York City. Art Tatum caught the ears of not only his jazz colleagues, but also classical musicians, conductor Leopold Stokowski, composer Sergei Rachmaninoff, and pianist Vladimir Horowitz were all fans. Billy Taylor recalls a legendary account between Tatum and Horowitz, who carefully wrote out variations on T for Two to impress Art.
He decided that he would take Vincent Heumann's composition T for Two, which was a song in those days that a lot of jazz musicians were playing, and do his version of it. So he worked some variations on T for Two and played them for Art. And so he said, "Do you play this?" And so Art said, "Yeah." And so he said, "Would you play it?" He said, "Sure." And he sat out and played his variations on T for Two. He said, "Well, how long did it take you to make that up?" He said, "I don't know. How long was it?"
You know, Horowitz was no slouch, let's face it, you know.
Hank Jones.
I mean, Horowitz, among other fine concert pianists, have all, you know, said that Tatum was a great creative artist, and he was. You know, this is an obvious thing. And the person who would appreciate it more than anybody else would be a concert pianist.
This is Tatum in 1940 with his version of Massenet's Elegy. Founded a challenge to characterize Tatum's style. James Lester.
The musicologist Felicity Howlett once used a phrase. She said, "He's like a hawk going after a fish, a hawk adjusting to the wind, judging the waves, and trying to predict the fish's turns and dives." So she catches the idea of this constant movement that's rushing through his playing. Another guy had picked up the way that Tatum tries to get so much into one little performance and described him as being like a big man in a suit too small for him, literally bursting out of songs, bringing to them the entire history of jazz piano. And that's kind of captures what it's like to listen to Tatum.
And to some people's ears, it's too much. Critics use words like garrulous, florid, congested.
I think the critics feel there wasn't enough judgment being applied. He wasn't choosing enough just what was right for the particular moment, but instead was sort of deploying all of his virtuosity all the time.
I don't think Tatum ever wasted a single note.
Hank Jones.
I think that every note that he played had a definite bearing on the chord progression or on the harmonic progression that he was involved in. He was a master of timing, a master of taste. That's another thing we forgot to mention. Tatum had the greatest taste of anybody I've ever heard, or perhaps more taste than anybody ever will have. And for anybody to make a statement that he played too much is absurd. It's absurd. It indicates a total ignorance of what he was trying to do.
He had a lot to say, and he said it eloquently.
Billy Taylor.
If you couldn't listen that fast, that was your problem. That was not his problem.
Clarinetist Buddy DeFranco.
I would liken him to Bartok in the classical symphonic field. Some people just can't hear it. It's too much. And that doesn't augur well for commerciality. That's one of the biggest problems Tatum faced. But he couldn't help himself. He played what he played, you know. He had to do it for those who could hear it.
By the late 1930s, Art Tatum had become one of the most highly respected pianists in the jazz field. But his playing resonated more amongst his peers than with the public. The label of musician's musician didn't seem to cause him too much concern, though, and he certainly never played down to an audience to please them. However, in the 1940s, he would take a different tack to overcome some of the barriers. That's coming up. I'm Nancy Wilson. You're listening to Jazz Profiles, a tribute to pianist Art Tatum on NPR National Public Radio. In 1943, Art Tatum made a move that surprised some and delighted others. The quintessential solo artist formed a trio with bassist Slam Stewart and guitarist Tiny Grimes. Their beginning was happenstance, the result of numerous after-hours jam sessions. But they were such a big hit with listeners, they decided to officially form a group. The trio became Art Tatum's greatest commercial success. He kept it together for over 10 years with just one personnel change in 1949, when Everett Barksdale took over as guitarist. Tatum Trio, playing Lover, with Slam Stewart on bass and Everett Barksdale on guitar. Throughout the 1940s, Tatum continued to be an icon for fellow musicians. His followers included leading beboppers of the day. Pianist Bud Powell considered Tatum his greatest influence. Saxophonist Charlie Parker took a job as a dishwasher in a club just so he could listen to Art play every night. Tatum especially inspired young pianists like Oscar Peterson.
He came to the club to hear me and scared the daylights out of me. Ray Brown kept telling me he was in the club. We had been playing a joke on each other from time to time. I'd hear Ray play something on the bass that was very hard conceptually or technically, and I'd say, "Hey, Ray, watch it. Oscar Petrovich just walked in." He'd say, "Oh, the hell with him." And if I did the same thing in piano, he'd say, "Well, look out, I think Art's in the house," and I'd say the same thing, knowing full well he wasn't there, except that this one night when we were playing Airman Special, he was there. I thought it was a gag at first that we were doing, and then suddenly, when Ray gets excited, his voice gets very high-pitched, he becomes a soprano. I looked down at the bar as he requested, and there he was. He met me, shook hands, and said, "You're that Canadian I've been hearing so much about that people say, you know." He said, "Well, you're quite the piano player, aren't you?" And I couldn't say anything. I was awestruck.
Singer John Hendricks recalls another encounter between Peterson and Tatum at a meeting of some of the leading pianists of the day.
What? Oscar came down from Toronto, and so all the piano players had a meeting, you know. They always had meetings when some new kid comes in. So all the pianists got together and everybody played. You know, James P. played, you know, Fats played, all the guys played. And then it got down to Oscar finally. And Oscar played and amazed everybody, you know, with his blazing technique, you know. And then it was Art's turn. So Art says to Oscar, says, "Oscar, that was very nice. Now I'd like to play this for you." And he played, "Little Man, You've Had a Busy Day." Art Tatum was mean.
At first, I couldn't play when he was around me.
Oscar Peterson.
Until one night in Los Angeles, after he'd given me my lecture, in which he said, "If you have to hate me to be able to play, you go ahead and hate me. But," he said, "you've got to play because you have something to say." And it was the greatest compliment I think I've ever been paid.
Thank you.
oddly enough, whenever I played for him, I won't say I played better, but he always settled me down for some reason or other. He was so encouraging once I got to know him.
Pianist Billy Taylor also found a mentor in Tatum.
I'd go over to his hotel room and talk to him, and I'd take him to some of the sports events that he liked. I took him to the relays one time, and, you know, he loved sports. But we didn't talk about music very much. I mean, we talked about ladies, talked about drinking, talked about other piano players and the movies. We talked about everything but music.
Though it wasn't readily apparent to those who didn't know him well, Tatum had a lot of interest outside of music. Not only was he a sports fanatic, he was also a card shark. Oscar Peterson remembers a game with bassist Ray Brown.
I remember Ray and I used to mess around with him, and he came over one night and we started playing cards. During the game, Ray started to reach for the deck, which it wasn't his turn to reach for the deck. And Art had his hand with the cards in it up close to his eyes as he looked at everything that close. And he, without moving the cards, he looked around and he said, "Ray Brown, the last person that tried that trick on me is drawing compensation." So he wasn't all that blind.
By the end of the 1940s, as bebop began to overtake the musical landscape, jobs were becoming scarce, both for Art Tatum, the soloist, and the trio. Tatum was having to play small clubs in remote places around the country just to make a living. But 1953 brought a tremendous opportunity when jazz producer Norman Granz proposed a project. Tatum biographer James Lester.
Granz decided this was a terrible shame, that Tatum was being lost, and decided what he wanted to do was make a kind of monument to him, bring him into the studio, and just record him for as long as he could, as long as Tatum was willing to play. It was kind of an unheard-of project.
In the most extensive recording project ever undertaken with any jazz figure, they cut 124 solos, 121 of which were released on 13 LPs, and they did it in record time. Art Tatum.
We did all of those records in, say, about three nights' work. We cut about 100 sides the first night. Every master, you go straight down. I mean, there's no retakes. And then you can do that when you're playing piano solo by yourself, and you don't have to worry about anybody else. So you're playing completely by yourself, and with me, I can do that.
This is In a Sentimental Mood, from the Tatum Solo Masterpieces. Sentimental Mood, from Volume 8 of the Tatum Solo Masterpieces, recorded December 29, 1953. You're listening to NPR's Jazz Profiles, a tribute to Art Tatum. I'm Nancy Wilson. after the solo sessions, Norman Granz began to assemble all-star groups to record with Tatum. Lionel Hampton, Buddy Rich, Benny Carter, Louis Belson, Roy Eldridge, Harry Sweets Edison, Ben Webster, and bebop clarinetist Buddy DeFranco, who walked into his session just as intimidated as everybody else was who played with Tatum.
Most people kind of felt that he was an angry type player and tried to pit himself against other musicians, to show them up, in other words. But when I worked with him, I realized that wasn't it at all. He was a real nice person, and he liked the game. He loved the idea of interchange and exchanging ideas with other players. A couple times during our session, he put one hand on his knee and played a couple choruses with one hand and looked in my direction and started grinning. And they played it back, and it was pretty hard to tell where he did that. It was that phenomenal.
Seven of the Tatum Group masterpieces, with Buddy DeFranco on clarinet, Red Callender on bass, and Bill Douglas on drums. DeFranco says that playing with Tatum was like chasing after a train that never stops. But it wasn't only Tatum's playing that amazed him.
I couldn't believe the quantity of beer that he drank. None of us could believe it. Norman was well aware of it. In fact, Norman had these containers of beer for Art. He drank a little gin once in a while, but he consumed an enormous amount of beer. And I wondered to myself, how in the world can he do this and still play as sharp as he did and play as fast as he did and was so agile? But he did, and drank gallons of beer. Couldn't believe it.
Tatum was rumored to drink a case of beer and sometimes up to 2 quarts of hard liquor in any 24-hour period. And by most accounts, it did not affect his playing. It did, however, affect his health. James Lester.
All his life, even from the time he was a teenager in Toledo, apparently, he was well known as a gigantic beer drinker. And that started in Prohibition days, so he had to really work at it. People often talked about his playing tee for two with his left hand and drinking the beer with his right hand alone. So the man spent a lifetime putting away alcohol on a huge scale. He also apparently had diabetes, and there is a deadly combination.
By 1952, Art had begun to show evidence of uremia, a toxic blood condition resulting from severe kidney disease. By 1956, he was very sick, but played it down and forged ahead with plans for the future, as it describes in this August 56 interview with Voice of America's Willis Conover.
I understand there's a possibility of a new trip to Europe coming up soon.
Yes, I think we're definitely coming to Europe in around March or April, something like that. I'm supposed to go over for Norman Granz for about 6 or 8 weeks.
Do you know yet which countries you'll touch?
From what I can understand, I think we go to Sweden, Germany, France, Belgium, all of the countries, I think, in Europe practically, but England. And of course, I'm sure we don't go into Russia or nothing like that.
Well, then here's a word for the listeners overseas. Art Tatum is on his way, and get those pianos in tune.
Yeah, that's correct. Hope to be over there quite soon.
But Art wouldn't make it to Europe. Over the next few months, his illness advanced. Oscar Peterson.
I went down to his home, and his wife Geraldine met me at the door and ushered me in. And the last I remember of Art Tatum was a grand piano that was rolled up into the corner of his living room, and it was covered. And that's my last view of Art Tatum.
Art Tatum died on November 5th, 1956, at age 47. Buried in Los Angeles, his gravestone says, very simply, someone to watch over me. Influenced countless musicians throughout his life. It's said that Fats Waller was once playing in a New York club when Art walked in. Fats stopped the music and announced to the audience, "Ladies and gentlemen, I play piano, but God is in the house tonight." And that's how Tatum was viewed by many people. He set a standard of virtuosity that has yet to be surpassed by any jazz pianist. Billy Taylor.
Art Tatum, to me, was the greatest jazz pianist of the 20th century. No one came close, in my opinion, no one came close to doing what he did.
Buddy DeFranco.
In fact, you know, Tatum rarely won any awards while he was alive, which is incredible, because he was the best in the world.
James Lester.
He just was, for a long time, the standard for excellence, and he was encouragement to everybody to play as well as they bloody well could.
John Hendricks.
He left such a high standard for anyone to approach. He lifted jazz piano to its proper height, and it's never been exceeded.
Hank Jones.
You know, in this century, in this generation, maybe 100, 200 years from now, there'll be another Art Tatum or somebody like that. I don't know. But we can say that he's the greatest performer that I've ever heard. Certainly anyone who has ever played jazz piano.
Oscar Peterson.
He was the complete package. He was the complete player, the complete instrumentalist, the complete orchestra.
Not much of a talker, so I don't know how to say it, but I really did appreciate being here. And thanks a lot, and I hope you invite me back again.
Our tribute to Art Tatum was written and produced by Molly Murphy, post-production engineer Todd Hauslander. Jazz Profiles is produced by Tim Owens. Assistant producer is Madeline Smith. Senior editor, Greg Fitzgerald. Website coordinator, John Murph. Recording assistance provided by Kareel Wheeler and NPR's New York Bureau. Wally Crawford at WKGC. Wayne Carrington, Bill Stanley,
and David Tarno. Special thanks to Sean Campanucci, Arnold Laubich, and James Lester. To email us, or for more information about this and other programs in our series, contact us through NPR's homepage on the World Wide Web at npr.org. That's npr.org. Major support for Jazz Profiles comes from the Lila Wallace Reader's Digest Fund, helping people to make the arts and culture an active part of their everyday lives. Additional support has been provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the National Endowment for the Arts. I'm Nancy Wilson, and this is NPR, National Public Radio.
Thanks for listening. To hear more programs in this series, go to npr.org/jazzprofiles.